Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. In today's episode, we'll be doing the recap of The Wendigo by Algernon Blackwood. This story was published in 1910.
This story was nominated to a ballot by one of our Patreon supporters, and well, am I glad it was. I mean, this is not a story that's new for me. It's a masterpiece. It's one I have loved since I was an adolescent, but somehow we've managed to get years and years into this project without covering it, so I'm extraordinarily grateful that one of our Patreon supporters finally has used a nomination to make this happen. So thank you so much for that, and of course, thank you to all the other Patreon supporters who voted for this story. It is a big story. It's a novella, really. As Brandon said, this is the recap episode. Hey, that means next time there's going to be a discussion episode. Before we get into it, though, we need to let you know that this month we are now on Patreon voting for next year's themed stories. That'll be, you know, 50% or so of what we do on Elder Sign next year. I'm always really excited about this type of voting that we do here, but I'm especially excited about it this year, Brandon, because at the behest of another really awesome Patreon supporter, we have added a category to the ballot. And this category is, on the ballot under the title Host's Choice. But what that really means is that it's you versus me, Brandon. It is Brandon versus Glenn. It is which host do you want to put stories on the ballot to vote for, Brandon or Glenn? You're not going to hurt our feelings here.
You'll be giving us one of us over the other. To do, really. I mean, it's feelings don't even come into it. You're giving us work.
Yeah, and I think this will. If this category wins, then yeah, the next vote will be Brandon versus Glenn. I think that will be a lot of fun. Certainly, I think behind the scenes, we will have to, be buying each other beer or something like that, right, whoever wins or something like that. But I think we should say ahead of time that we are not, we're both committed to not using that as an opportunity to have a kind of sleeper or secret theme, right? So if you vote for me, well, I can promise, I guess this is a campaign promise, I'm going to put an H.P. Lovecraft story on that ballot, but I'm not going to put only Lovecraft on that ballot. It's not going to be a secret way to have, for me to have a Lovecraft only ballot or interwar only ballot or something like that. And Brandon will do the same, right? Brandon is not going to only put stories from, after the year 2000 on the ballot or something like that, that we will try to, put on the ballot a representation of the breadth of our individual interests and so on. But I think it will be fun to see, which of those interests our listeners prefer.
I can guarantee you, though, that my interests will be rooted in, or at least inspired in somewhat by authors who have made it into Valancourt books, paperbacks from hell. I have one novella in mind that I've been aching to read that I will use this as an opportunity to get the podcast to buy us the copies of this book. So you and I can do one of those novellas. Glenn, my head is spinning with ideas now. And so maybe it will be a competition and maybe there will have to be beer involved. But what an awesome theme. What an awesome, awesome idea. I think no matter who wins, we're going to have some great horror stories should this theme win on the ballot. In order to, vote for this ballot option, you need to join us on Patreon in order to vote. If you haven't already, go to claytemplemedia.com/Patreon. Pick the price tier that works best for you. You can vote. We also have, Glenn, like 120 episodes, of bonus content on Patreon, including a Sherlock Holmes series, H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, older TV show reviews. I mean, just a host of episodes that you don't get from the main shows. And it's worth your while, for sure. At least we think so. Let's turn our attention now to, I almost said Blackwood's baby, Glenn, because there's a lot in common. We really see Laird Barron's, the influence on Laird Barron's story there in The Wendigo. But we're talking about The Wendigo. I, like you, Glenn, I mean, I had not read this story before. This knocked my socks off, gave me a huge amount to think about. And I know why you loved it. I don't know if you know why I loved it. We're going to sort all that out as we get through this episode. Let's jump into the recap.
Yeah, right. I think you and I definitely know that we both love this story, but I think that we will discover that it's for very different reasons. And actually, that makes this probably a pretty great episode for us to be saying, hey, listeners, you should be thinking about whether you want to hear a bunch of stories Brandon picked or a bunch of stories Glenn picked. The differences between us, I think, will be crystallized in maybe less this episode, but the discussion episode 2 weeks hence, I think will be perfect for laying out exactly what is at stake there. Right. Blackwood has very kindly divided this novella into 9 chapters, and we're going to more or less follow his guidance here for organizing our own conversation here around the recap. Now, this first chapter tells us where the story is set, who the characters are, and then also gives a general sense of what kind of story this is going to be. The Wendigo is more or less contemporary to its publication, and so we're in, the 1890s, early 1900s here. We are also in Canada. Specifically, we are in the vast, forested, and lake-filled wilderness of Northwest Ontario. For Americans, or just people more familiar with U.S. geography, what we're talking about here is Minnesota, which is to say the land of 1,000 lakes, except it's 200 miles further north than that. And it is late October, so this part of the world is really on the cusp of autumn and winter. Our characters are some dudes who have traveled here to hunt moose. The principal hunters are 2 men from Scotland, Dr. Cathcart and his nephew Simpson. Dr. Cathcart is a psychologist who has written a book called Collective Hallucination, and that's probably going to come back in the story in some way. Simpson, on the other hand, is a divinity student who will eventually be a minister in the Church of Scotland. And Cathcart has hired 2 guides, one for himself and one for Simpson, and these are Hank Davis and Joseph DeFago. DeFago is the character who is going to matter here. He is a French-Canadian from Quebec. Blackwood gives a lot more description about DeFago, but I'll let Brandon handle that because there is still one more character that we need to list, and that is Punk. Punk is a native. Blackwood uses the word Indian, but really just leaves his ethnicity and language and culture unspecified beyond that. Punk is the camp hand, which is to say he stays in camp while everyone else is out hunting. He makes sure that there is food and coffee when everyone gets back. He also does the dishes. All right, so that is the setting, that's the characters, but we do still need to talk about the setup. The deal is that the moose just don't seem to be around this year, and so the hunting party is discussing where they should go next in order to find some moose. Now, Hank wants to split up, but it is pretty clear that DeFago does not want to take Simpson where Hank says that he should, and it comes out that there is some kind of native fairy tale that has DeFago spooked, but Hank goads DeFago into agreeing to the plan, and it is pretty clear that, well, it's already all doomed at this point.
Yeah, it's doomed at least in the sense that any hunting trip where no game is brought back is a doomed hunting trip. We get that from the first paragraph, along with the bit about Cathcart's book, Collective Hallucinations, and the fact that this story that we're getting could have probably been a case study in that book. But Cathcart was not an observer of this hunting trip. He was a participant. So, that's why he didn't use what we're about to get as a case study in Collective Hallucinations. So the first paragraph of The Wendigo gives us a great hook and maybe even suggests to us that it's Cathcart's colleague that's telling us the story that Cathcart himself cannot tell. But even if this reference to a colleague that Cathcart talked to is not a hint as to the true author of this tale, it's not really a high-stakes question, but it is one I think that puzzled both of us, Glenn. We can see Blackwood's journalism training on display. We get facts along with a little editorializing, along with reference to sources that were spoken to after the fact. And ultimately, while this journalistic style returns here and there in the story, we get, a scene at the end of this chapter with Punk sniffing the wind that indicates that this might be a third-person omniscient narrator. Why does this matter? Well, maybe it doesn't. But I think on the craft level, this is something that if you were to write a story now, you'd want to have a surer hand over just who the narrator is or what their role is or what position the narrator is in relation to the narrative in today's market. But all in all, the opening paragraph of The Wendigo is a good an opening as any, as I've read in a short story or novella.
I think something that you're pointing to here, Brandon, is that the tone of really the whole story, but especially this opening, is, well, a feeling as if we, the reader, are being addressed. And even though none of it really is technically in the second person, it all kind of feels like it is, right? And that then inherently also gives us the feeling that there must be an identifiable person who is narrating the story to us, someone within the world of the story. But as you say, that's not explicit in the text at all. And I think that, you know, if I had to put money on it, I would say that this is a third person omniscient story. It just happens to open, especially with this this mood that feels more intimate than a third person omniscient story usually does.
There's all sorts of bits of text in this story, littered throughout the story, that break us out of that omniscience, that make us think we're getting, I don't know, some kind of reporting being done, right? Somebody's done the interviews. Somebody's compiled this. Yeah, but at the end of the day, I'd have to say this is third-person omniscient as well. And it's just an interesting technique. I don't think you would quite get away with it today. I think an editor today would say you need to adjust these six phrases in order to keep the narrative perspective tight. But it really works in the stories. I really, in my own writing, have been toying with this kind of journalistic voice. And I think that this is a really good example of how to use that to engage the reader in a story.
Absolutely. The voice of this, the mood of this just sucks you in. And I, you know, I do wonder, you know, I think in the discussion, we'll probably talk a little bit more about Blackwood's biography, but yeah, he's a reporter, right? That's his professional training. This kind of feels like it's reporter writing. I mean, really, really, really good reporter writing. But I think that that voice, that mood that he has here, this giving the reader a sense of being addressed, that might come out of, that might come out of journalism.
Yeah, 100%. Let's dig into the characters a little bit more here. Hank Davis is one of these characters. He's one of the guides. He speaks primarily in dialect. He's a rough character. He's pretty racist. I mean, all these guys are pretty racist when it comes to the quote-unquote Indian punk. But in any case, Hank and DeFago are old acquaintances. DeFago's been around the block, and he has DeFago has, quote, unparalleled knowledge of woodcraft and bush lore, and, quote, could also sing the old Voyager songs and tell a capital hunting yarn. Also here, the Voyagers were like the fur trappers in Canada. A lot of lore and legends around their activities, travels, movements through the woods, the types of people they were. But furthermore, DeFago, quote, was deeply susceptible to that singular spell which the wilderness lays upon certain lonely natures. And he loved the wild solitudes with a kind of romantic passion that amounted almost to an obsession. It's also stressed to us that DeFago is open to the mysteries, lore, and tales of the woods, perhaps because he spent so much time by himself in the deep woods. And as I mentioned before on, you know, in Elder Sign in general, I think if you don't have a pretty good taxonomical handle on the wilderness, you know, when you're there, it's really easy to fall into superstition. I think even if you have a really good sense of what kind of sounds animals make, what sort of animals are, you know, liable to be walking on their hind legs, you know, all the sorts of eerie things you see in the wilderness, not knowing about it makes it incredibly eerie, but even knowing about it can be pretty shocking sometimes.
Yeah, not just wilderness generally. I mean that is true. I don't want to disagree with that, but I also just want to say specifically woods. At least this has been my personal experience as someone who has spent a lot of time outdoors, a lot of time in backcountry, camping, hiking, mountaineering more generally by myself. It's the woods. It's always the forest that for me is the scariest place to be. You can't see anything, right? When you're above tree line, you know what's out there. You have a sense of what's there. But when you can't see very far, you know, the trees just obscure your visibility, and the trees themselves are the source of noises in addition to all of the creatures that are moving around in the forest that you'll never see. It is It's just downright spooky, downright unsettling.
Yeah, and so this is a perfect setting for a horror story. And man, Blackwood just does everything right here.
He absolutely does. And yeah, as you said, you know exactly what it is that I love about this story. And it is this stuff, right? And you just absolutely read this story and leave it knowing that Blackwood has experience here, that he knows what he's talking about, that this is not a writer, you know, just sitting at home in his study, never having gone camping before, but thinking it would be fun to tell a wilderness horror story because that's a genre of horror that would be fun to write, but not really maybe having a lot of direct experience about it. You know that Blackwood has done this, that he's been out here and that it's gotten into him as he's writing this. And it's really phenomenal. And that's a good segue, I think, to get into chapter two, which is a lot of mood. I mean, generally speaking, the story is a lot of mood. It's a lot of mood building. It's a lot of description. You in the past, Brandon, have leveled a charge at Blackwood of being repetitive. And I suspect you will find some of this repetitive as well. But I don't care how repetitive it is. I love it. It could be more repetitive, I think, actually, and I would still love it. But I'm going to have to ignore most of that and just stick to the plot details. And then Brandon can give us some examples of the landscape descriptions and the mood and so on. And you might be wondering, I suppose, if that is the best plan, right? Given that Brandon generally, you know, doesn't like all the thick description, especially in Blackwood and what we've gotten in the past. But I assure you that the alternative is that I just read the entire story to you over the course of 4 hours. Nobody actually wants that. So yeah, let's get the gist of chapter two here. It is the next morning. It has snowed overnight and the smell of winter is in the air. And it is time to break camp and split the party. So our narrative now, and I should say narrator, right? I mean, there does seem to be a definite author to this piece, though that's not present on every page, as we've hinted at, that's something we're going to need to take up in the discussion a little bit more after we have the whole story under our belts. But at any rate, the narrator now follows Simpson and DeFago as they set out on their journey to a place called 50 Island Water to find some moose that they can shoot. Now, the descriptions of the landscape and the labor of this journey, I think, are just breathtaking. Blackwood really takes his time getting us to the next camp. But once we are there, Simpson confesses that he's not comfortable in these endless woods. But they table that conversation. They try to forget it. But then DeFago starts sniffing the air like an animal. And Simpson tries to get DeFago to tell him what he smells, but DeFago just won't say anything at all. But it is clear to us, the reader, that Simpson is unsettled. I mean, he was already unsettled in this environment, but now it is worse. He knows that DeFago smells something, and that that something is not a moose. And eventually, DeFago explains that he thought he smelled a Wendigo. But since Simpson hasn't smelled anything at all, it might just be in his head. And then it's time to get in the tent and go to sleep, and probably everything will be just fine.
Well, Glenn, I have to say up front here that I think you're right on two counts here. The first count being that everything will be just fine, and it will be for almost all the characters of this story by the time we get to the end of it. But on the second count, you are right to point out that I typically don't like it when authors spill ink in the shape of landscape descriptions that don't do anything for the story, save pad word count. There are natural exceptions to that, of course, but you know, one of the exceptions, I guess, is when a description is in service to establishing setting and atmosphere. This can be very powerful. But secondly, I don't mind a focus on the environment or landscape when the author is clearly engaging with a mode or tradition that explicitly requires, a little extra ink on the page. And I think that Blackwood is definitely engaged with a tradition or mode of writing that is leaning heavily on elements of the romantic movement. I'm going to save my comments on this for our discussion episode, but I think that it's impossible to ignore the way in which Blackwood is relying on the romantic concept of the sublime here in creating the atmosphere he's shooting for out of the description of landscapes and nature and so on. That's going to really be the first thing we focus on in our discussion, is the way that Blackwood is engaging with romanticism and maybe also offering a critique of it as well.
I'm very excited about that. I mean, I think that I would describe Blackwood as a romantic writer, even though chronologically he's much later than that. But that could be something for sure that we'll take up in the discussion that I will be very excited about.
Yeah, I think we have to. I mean, I don't know. Some scholars out there have termed like modernism, which comes after romanticism, or like real literary realism or something, movements like that as like hyper-romanticism to some degree. We don't need to get deep in the categories. I think that romanticism will be a helpful lens through which we can engage with this story. But to engage also with the story itself, Glenn, you said I had to read some stuff into the mic, so I'm going to do that. let me give an example of the writing here that includes the onset of winter, or at least signifiers of winter, which is something we'll also want to consider in our discussion. So here's, I'm quoting from the text. The wintry sharpness of the air was tempered now by a sun that topped the wooden ridges and blazed with a luxurious warmth upon the world of lake and forest below. Loons flew, skimming through the sparkling spray that the wind lifted. Divers shook their dropping heads to the sun and upped smartly out of sight again. And as far as I could reach rose the leagues of endless, crowding bush, desolate in its lonely sweep and grandeur, untrodden by foot of man, and stretching its mighty and unbroken carpet right up to the frozen shores of Hudson Bay. Now, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any reader who found this description excessive or repetitive in any way. The landscape here, the woods and environment these characters find themselves in, is as much a character in this story as a city or town is in a piece of good pulp detective fiction.
That just gave me chills just hearing you read this. I'm now regretting my decision to not let me read all of the descriptions into the microphone, though I stand by it as the smart decision, or we would have nothing but Glenn reading landscape descriptions into the microphone.
We'll have opportunities in our discussion episode to read more passages. Really, I'm just going to let you read as many as you want to cap off our episodes here. I want to say something else about Simpson, as he's described to us in chapter 2, before we move on as well. Blackwood, or the author of The Wendigo, stresses that Simpson really is devout in his faith. He's been to Switzerland, we see in the story, and maybe he's even been to the Alps, which is a classic example of the sublime in Romanticism. And Simpson has experienced somewhat of what I've talked about how disturbing or bewildering, which is the text term, the wilderness really can be, even if you're familiar with material taxonomies and so forth. You know, for Simpson, quote, to dwell in the primeval forests and to seek acquaintance with their wildlife was an initiation that no intelligent man could undergo without a certain shifting of personal values hitherto held for permanent and sacred. So in other words, while Simpson is open to there being a spiritual world, or even devoutly believes in a spiritual world, being in this deep nature has given him a different perspective on creation, on wildness, and on perhaps what it means to encounter the sacred. And the sacred, I'll mention here, is a term used a lot in religion, but it's sometimes helpful to simply consider its simplest definition of being that which is set apart, particularly that which a deity sets apart for themselves, like a people or a form of worship or a place. But the question of the wilderness that remains largely untouched by human hands is a question of who has set the wilderness apart and for what purpose. But in any event, this question of a metaphysics that accounts for this sort of spiritualism versus a rational and materialist approach to the world is raised for the first time here with Simpson. We'll see it raised again. And to underscore this, I want to read one more passage from chapter 2, and then we can leave our general praise of the writing for our discussion episode. So here we are in chapter 2 once again. The dusk rapidly deepened. The glades grew dark. The crackling of the fire and the wash of little waves along the rocky lake shore were the only sounds audible. The wind had dropped with the sun, and in all that vast world of branches, nothing stirred. Any moment, it seemed, the woodland gods, who are to be worshipped in silence and loneliness, might stretch their mighty and terrific outlines among the trees. In front, through doorways pillared by huge straight stems, lay the stretch of 50 Island Water, a crescent-shaped lake some 15 miles from tip to tip, and perhaps 5 miles across where they camped. A sky of rose and saffron, more clear than any atmosphere Simpson had ever known, still dropped its pale streaming fires across the waves, where the islands, 100, surely rather than 50, floated like the fairy barks of some enchanted fleet. Fringed with pines, whose crests fingered most delicately the sky, they almost seemed to move upwards as the light faded, about to weigh anchor and navigate the pathways of the heavens instead of the currents of their native and desolate lake. And the strips of colored cloud, like flaunting pennons, signaled their departure to the stars. The beauty of this scene was strangely uplifting. Simpson smoked the fish and burnt his fingers in the bargain in his efforts to enjoy it and at the same time tend the frying pan and the fire. And so, yeah, this passage again gives us a look into Simpson's encounter with the sacred, his openness to the metaphysics of the forest.
This is, I think, the central thing that Blackwood is doing in this story. So obviously, as you're saying, we're going to talk about this at length in the discussion. So for now, I'll just say that I do think that Simpson here is a stand-in for Blackwood, that this is Blackwood's own feelings about his experiences of this wilderness and also his experience of his early travels in Switzerland as well, that Simpson really means Blackwood here. And so we're getting Blackwood's feelings about this type of environment, how that for him is a kind of sacred spiritual experience. And I'm looking forward to unpacking as much of that as we can in the discussion. But one thing I do want to point out about the passage that you've just read here is that Blackwood is giving us this beautiful wilderness description. He's also having Simpson, be present in that it is an omniscient, it is a third person description, but it is through the eyes of Simpson. And so we're there not just seeing and hearing and smelling as Simpson, we're feeling as Simpson as well. And importantly, I think seeing the metaphors that Simpson himself is using in experiencing this are numinous, right? They're supernatural in some way that maybe doesn't even have anything to do with the actual or possibly supernatural element that we're going to get in the plot eventually.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, it's just a darn good bit of writing.
It is at that. All right, let's move on here. Chapters 3, 4, and 5 are both much shorter than these first two chapters. So I am here going to combine them into one recap section for us. But things, it turns out, really are not just fine, at least not for Simpson and Defago here. Simpson wakes up in the middle of the night to the sound of Defago crying. Defago will not answer him, will not talk to him at all, and may even be crying in his sleep. But Simpson notices that Defago's feet are sticking out of the tent and are uncovered. It seems as if Defago has been dragged a little bit by someone reaching into the tent. But at any rate, Simpson puts a blanket over Defago's feet and goes back to sleep to the sounds of his tent mate crying and with the feeling that the wilderness is observing them, that it's listening to them. Simpson wakes up again at dawn and Defago is still crying or maybe crying again, though really this time what he's doing is quivering, but he still will not answer Simpson. And then someone out in the woods calls out Defago's name. But it's not really a human voice. Rather, it's a sort of windy, crying voice, as of something lonely and untamed, wild, and of abominable power. I'm quoting there. And Defago responds to this call. He gets up and runs into the woods with surprising speed. And as he's running off, he shouts, "Oh, oh, my feet of fire, my burning feet of fire. Oh, oh, this height and fiery speed." And Simpson tries to go after Defago, and when it's clear that that is impossible, he calls for Defago and searches for him, but to no avail. He does find, though, some bizarre tracks that are from something large, but something that is definitely not a moose. He also finds, moving along with these other prints, he finds Defago's tracks. And then, eventually, Defago's own prints transform into the same kind of strange, bizarre, non-moose prints as the other tracks. There are also some weird sounds in the woods, like someone tapping an axe handle on trees. But nothing comes of it, and frankly, Simpson is getting weirded out, so he leaves a note for Defago at their camp and then sets out to return to the group's base camp to get help.
Something I could have pointed out earlier, I guess, but I think now is as good a time as any to point it out, is the fact that fire is a major motif in the story. We heard many instances of fire in the passage that I read, you know, relating to the way the sun feels on the water, but also Simpson burning his fingers and so on. Maybe we'll consider some of this in the discussion as well, but right now, the section of the story that you've just recapped here, we've got fire feet. We have a fire that destroyed a section of the woods last year, which might have to do with the moose not being out. Campfires all over the place, matches as an important camp tool. And so maybe we do have to consider how this motif is put into contrast with the encroaching winter. We could also take a moment here, I think, to acknowledge Blackwood's engagement or writing from the perspective of scientific racism, right? There are indications that many, if not all, of the characters' behaviors in the Wendigo can be explained by the racial qualities associated with, say, Simpson being a Scotsman or Punk being an Indian, Defago as a Quebecois, and so on, rather than by the way they've been formed by their upbringing, their material environments, and so on, life choices, what have you. I mean, much of Defago's behavior can be understood in the context of some unmentioned or undisclosed trauma, perhaps, associated with being a voyager or any of the other daring things that he's done with his life and sought solitude as a means of coping, that perhaps Defago is too near something like a natural state of being. And what I mean by this, again, will be explored when we get to our discussion. And consider the ways in which Blackwood is explicitly engaging with the romantics and the way that they conceive of nature or nature versus the social world. And I guess what I'd like to emphasize is the excellent way in which Blackwood captures the fear and horror of sleeping in the wild. You realize as you lay your head down to sleep, that nylon or silk are not really the sturdiest walls with which you can keep animals at bay. You're in their territory as well. I think it's also good advice that if you smell strong animal odors before setting up your campsite, you should probably move along to somewhere that smells slightly less like a pride of lions or what have you. But, in any event, I think Blackwood's ability to capture the fears of the wild while ascribing them cosmic significance or even having some sort of platonic idea attached to them. And Blackwood does this by using certain words like panic as a proper noun. This is all, as I said, just really excellent. And I think also true of my experience in the wild as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Blackwood does just such an amazing job of building up the, not really horror yet, but terror and panic, right, as this proper noun, panic that is happening in Simpson as just little bits of strangeness accumulate and take on this weight. And then you get the actual, like, really unsettling thing happening here with Defago just running off, someone calling Defago's name, Defago then just running off after that. And yeah, the only proper response there, I think, just has to be to nope out, right? I've got to go get help. I can't be alone doing this. There's got to be strength in numbers here, or I'm just as doomed as Defago is, not even knowing what's happened to Defago, right? Which we may not really ever fully understand, even at the end of this story. But yeah, Blackwood builds all of that up just so so awesomely, so wonderfully. And I'm glad here, I know we're gonna move on to the next bit here and save this for the discussion, but I'm glad that you want to talk about the way that Blackwood is ascribing people's traits to something in their hereditary rather than something in their upbringing. This will, I hope, give me a chance, really, to make up for the way that I bungled that when we were talking about or trying to talk about those things in Lovecraft's The Horror at Red Hook last year. So yeah, maybe I can make some amends there. But let's go on now. We're going to combine chapters 6 and 7 as well. It takes Simpsons 2 days to get back to the base camp, but at least he is lucky that everyone else is actually there when he arrives. He tries to tell them what happened to Defago, but he finds it difficult to talk about the weirder parts of it. And this means then that the rest of the group doesn't really have a complete picture of what has happened. And so they're operating on the idea, and really it's Dr. Cathcart's idea, but the idea that Defago is experiencing some kind of mania, but still they're going to go search for him. A lot of this section is about Simpson gradually providing more of the details to his uncle, Dr. Cathcart, that is, but then also about Dr. Cathcart explaining away the weirdness and maybe also like diagnosing Simpson with some milder form of mania of his own. There is a lot of discussion and commentary about the psychological effects of being out in a wilderness like this. But when they don't find Defago anywhere, or find any signs of Defago either, Hank finally explains that he and Defago knew about a Wendigo sighting around here a year ago. It's why Defago didn't want to take Simpson up to 50 Mile Island in the first place. Now, of course, Hank is the one who shamed Defago for his fear and his caution, and the narrator believes that Hank now feels some remorse about that. But Hank also explains that seeing the Wendigo, as a phrase, seeing the Wendigo, is probably just a native expression for going crazy. And those are all Hank's words here. Now, it turns out, though, that Dr. Cathcart has some knowledge of Wendigo lore, though to be clear, he does not think that the Wendigo is a real entity, a real creature or life form of some sort either. Now, Hank also knows some things, and together, the two of them give us, the readers, some sense of what the Wendigo is all about. The Wendigo has a strange voice that sounds like the wilderness. It travels so quickly that it burns its own feet off and then grows new ones. It also can travel high up, jumping into the air and running on the treetops. The Wendigo will bring a person with it and then also drop that person from way up high, but apparently not to eat it because the Wendigo diet is mostly moss. Now, all of this conversation, this has all been happening at night. The three men have given up searching for Defago, but are waiting until the next day to actually get out of here. And they're all pretty uncomfortable in the dark wilderness at this point. Now, Hank calls out into the night, and he says it's because he senses that Defago is nearby. And certainly, something is nearby. They hear a voice cry out, "Oh, oh, this fiery height! Oh, oh, my feet of fire! My burning feet of fire!" And then, there's a series of thuds as something falls from the top of the trees down to the ground. Then, there are footsteps crunching in the snow, getting closer and closer. But they can't see anything. And that is the chapter break, an awesome chapter break, I have to say.
It is, yeah. Maybe the Wendigo's just an owl. I mean, that's certainly one potential interpretation of what the Wendigo is. I'll get into that a little bit more. But in chapter 6, we get the author of the Wendigo, or maybe Blackwood's own critique of materialism as a philosophical approach or engagement with reality. Now, recall that Cathcart has written a book about collective hallucination. So I want to read this quote from the text in chapter 6 that offers this critique, perhaps of Cathcart's position on, again, a materialist reality. Dr. Cathcart, adroit psychologist that he fancied himself to be, had assured him clearly enough exactly where his mind, influenced by loneliness, bewilderment, and terror, had yielded to the strain and invited delusion. While praising Simpson's conduct, he managed at the same time to point out where, when, and how his mind had gone astray. He made his nephew think himself finer than he was by judicious praise, yet more foolish than he was by minimizing the value of evidence. Like many another materialist, that is, he lied cleverly on the basis of insufficient knowledge, because the knowledge supplied seemed, to his own particular intelligence, inadmissible. And Cathcart goes on to say that terrible solitude can do strange things to the mind. It is this that Cathcart thinks is a better consolation than the reality that Défago has been taken by a Wendigo. And I mean, this whole situation would be so panic-inducing. It is a big deal, as Blackwood points out, that Simpson was able to navigate the situation at all. I mean, how long do you wait for your guide to return? How deep into the woods do you go if you only have a tiny smattering of bushcraft to help you find your own camp again if you leave it? There are no easy answers to these questions if you're faced with this situation. And I think the only wrong thing to do, should you be abandoned by your guide who somehow becomes inhuman, at least based on the evidence that you are able to scrape up of their disappearance, the only wrong thing to do would be to take no action at all. And so I think Simpson really gets points for taking action. And even Cathcart recognizes this while wanting to ascribe the rest of what Simpson experiences as delusional. I'd also like to bring up the way that Cathcart characterizes what the Wendigo is as a metaphor. For Cathcart, the Wendigo is a personification of, quote, the call of the wild, which some natures hear to their own destruction. So once again, we are dealing with nature as some kind of original setting for being versus nature as the wild. There's an English professor out of Arizona State University named Dr. Emily Zarka, and she hosted a show called Monstrum on PBS. I think her main focus as an academic is British Romanticism, but monsters are really a big part of that. So anyway, her interpretation of the Wendigo as metaphor is dealing with the encroachment of winter, the embodiment of hunger, and the personification of selfishness. So I recommend folks check out her video on the topic. I found it on YouTube. It's about 8 minutes, and it gives a really nice gloss on the subject, including the fact that the Wendigo, the word, comes from the Ojibwe language group, which, you know, the Algonquins are a part of. And I don't know. We'll have time to dig into this stuff more in our discussion episode. But Punk's been out of the picture for a long time, and it seems like Blackwood missed an opportunity here to have Punk be a bigger and more important character of the Wendigo, offering some of this, you know, native or Indian lore about what the Wendigo is, you know, especially in terms of food scarcity and so on.
This is certainly a critique that we can offer up of the story, right? Is the lens that Blackwood uses to tell this story, that he's got, you know, there's a menu, right, of options of how do I want to tell this story? I've heard of the Wendigo. I've heard of this, you know, when I myself have traveled through Canada. I want to turn that into a story. And then you've got a menu of options of, you know, ways to go about doing that. Blackwood has picked one. I'm certainly glad we have the story as it exists. But there are other ways to go about doing this. And in fact, I would say that we've read one of them. It's called Ghost Story by Peter Straub, right? And that is, I think, definitely something we can take up in the discussion as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't even think you need to do too much with Punk's point of view. You just need to have him say, hey, my people know a lot about this, and here's what we know. You know, just bring him in as a character with a perspective, a history, and a point of view. That's not the kind of critiques we get up to over here. To me, I'm coming at it from a storytelling perspective, right? To add a reality effect to the story. But let's return to the Wendigo here. We are right at the point in chapter 7 where everyone's neurosis is on display. We learn how each of these characters deal with panic and terror. Cathcart and Hank, you know, like, just don't shut up. They just won't stop talking the whole night. While Simpson keeps him to himself, as he's been kind of trained to do in this situation, and by which I mean he very quickly learns that Cathcart and Hank don't really want to hear the full narrative of what he saw out in the wilderness. Cathcart tries to draw it out of Simpson a little bit, but then scolds Simpson for being delusional. So he's really trained to keep quiet here, even in this brief interaction he's had since getting out of the wilderness. So I will say this about the Wendigo descending perhaps from the trees or moving from treetop to treetop invisibly. This does square with the idea that I brought up earlier, that one translation for Wendigo is just the word for owl. So again, we are dealing with, say, the irrational mind trying to explain what it experiences in the dark of the woods.
Right. Though we know that, yeah, you know, chapter 7 ends with the sound of these footsteps, right? These creaky footsteps on the frost. And that's probably not an owl, though maybe it is. I suppose that in itself would be a pretty terrifying thing. Well, chapter 8 picks up with those footsteps. And, well, it's not an owl. It's a human figure that emerges from the darkness and stands right on the cusp of light and shadow at the outskirts of the fire. It's Defago, but he looks and sounds terrible. His voice has that eerie, unnatural quality, and Blackwood describes Defago's changed appearance as that between a person at 60 versus that same person at 20. Now, of course, it turns out that it is not Defago at all. It's the Wendigo appearing as Defago, pretending to be Defago. But we don't know why or, you know, what the purpose of this visit is, because as soon as all three members of the hunting party are convinced that it is not really Defago, he just stumbles off and then up into the treetops again. And Dr. Cathcart now stays up. He keeps watch the whole night, but nothing else happens. And so at dawn, they break camp and they get on their way.
Blackwood's writing in this chapter really delves into the uncanny, and it just has such a chilling effect on the story on the reader. I mean, I was scared. You know, I had to leave my blanket fort for a few minutes and get out and walk around the living room. But, you know, there are a few things to note in this chapter besides the way that Blackwood is writing terror and horror literature here. The main one I want to point out here is probably just a good survival tip. Should you be in the woods and come across a monstrous doppelganger of a lost companion, look at their feet. You know, if their feet look like indescribably horrifying clumps of something, you're dealing with a Wendigo. But if your, you know, companion is wearing the shoes they hiked in with, I think you'll be all right. The next thing I want to point out is the way that Blackwood returns to this fire motif. The Wendigo version of Defago mentions he's had a hellfire of a trip. He's got those fiery, burning feet that are the telltale signs that, you know, you've seen a Wendigo or been changed by one in some way. And then also related to the feet, we've got this partial phrase, which I'll read and then comment on. This is something Hank says. The phrase in the text is this: "How terrible in the wilderness are the feet of them." And this partial phrase is spoken, as I said, by a gibbering Hank, who also hallucinates people with burning faces trying to invade the camp. But the phrase that Hank is butchering here is a quote from the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, which goes like this: "How beautiful on the mountain are the feet of those that bring good news." And the good news that is being brought is the returning rule, or the continued established rule of God as king on earth. And so the inversion of this passage, especially with all of this fire imagery, smacks to me of a kind of invasion of hell that these men are experiencing. And all of this is to say that Blackwood is really in control of his imagery and language, which contributes so well to the horrors of this chapter.
Yeah, I want to go back to the feet business here. I mean, one reading of this story might just be that Blackwood's really into feet for some reason.
He's the Tarantino of weird fiction.
That is exactly what I was thinking. I just could not set aside an image from Pulp Fiction while you were describing the feet, which I guess I hadn't realized. I kind of intentionally kept the feet out of the recap. And maybe this is actually one of the places where you were saying that, you know, we'll see how you and I both really love this story. But liked different things about it, that I did not want to talk about the feet at all. And you wanted to dive right in. Well, look, we have come now to chapter 9, which is the final chapter. So we're nearly done with the recap. And then I think we can get to the discussion, which you and I are both clearly very eager to do. But let's recap this chapter first. Blackwood begins chapter 9 by meditating about what the Wendigo might be, but I will save that for Brandon to bring up, and really maybe save that for the discussion episode, I suppose, where this is obviously one of the questions that we will have to ask or try to answer. But instead, I will narrate the concluding events, though I'm going to do it differently than Blackwood himself does. Back at the base camp, where Punk has been tending the fire, a shadowy human figure creeps toward the fire. Punk sees it, also smells it, and then he just nopes out, though apparently he does connect with the group again later. This may be years later. Anyway, an hour after that, the hunting party returns to the base camp, and Hank sees a figure, a human, collapsed on the ground near the fire. It's Defago, and this time it is really the real Defago. Defago has no memory of what happened to him, and he's in bad physical shape. I mean, really, his mind and his body are broken at this point. The hunting party tries to care for him, but he lives for only a few more weeks. And then, back home in Scotland, Dr. Cathcart and his nephew Simpson resume their lives, and we even get a snippet of one of Simpson's later sermons here. But they do not talk about this episode, except just once. And when this happens, Dr. Cathcart just tells Simpson that it's better not to know what they encountered, better not to know what happened. And that's the story.
Well, I will say first that you've elided that it's really Simpson asking about feet that Dr. Cathcart doesn't want to talk about. So I guess in this case, you're the Dr. Cathcart and I am the Simpson. Simpson just wants to know what the feet looked like. And Dr. Cathcart's like, well, I'll never talk about those feet in my whole life ever again. But yeah, let's douse tonight's campfire here and sleep until dawn in preparation for our discussion episode. We've got lots to talk about and we do need our rest. So that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. And please, please do join us on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia. You can vote for what next year's stories are going to be and also gain access to scores and scores of episodes, including some really great series of episodes that we have done. And in fact, eventually we are on the books as being obligated for this, a series on Algernon Blackwood's other wilderness horror masterpiece, The Willows. That'll be coming up in about a year, I guess, on Patreon. But all right, next time here is the discussion episode for The Wendigo. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.